We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
My guest today is Anne Maria DeMars, first American world champion in judo. She has four kids, one of which is Ronda Rousey, the current UFC women's bantamweight champion. She has 4 degrees, culminating in a doctorate in applied statistics. She is currently running a successful education gaming company, Seven Generation Games, focused on teaching math to kids. And she writes a hell of an awesome blog at drannemaria.blogspot.com. For those that know her, she's not afraid to tell it like it is. And as she said in an interview I heard, "I have a theory about everything. Quote, it may not be correct, but it sounds logical." So today I want to explore a couple of her theories of human nature, math, and of course a little judo. I read that your grandmother was a big role model to you growing up. Can you tell her story and what lessons you took from her?
My grandmother was amazing. Her name was Amelia Maria Castilla. And actually, my daughter Maria is named after her, and my granddaughter Amelia is named after her. And I think she's an example of how one person can have a continuing effect for good in life. And I will never be as good of a person as she was. She was the kind of person that gave the Bible and Catholics a good name. And there are some people who are the opposite, you know?
Yes.
She used to tell me all the time that, you know, God gives you talents in life and you have nothing that God wants. So the only way that you could show your gratitude for that is do the best you can with everything that you were given. And she thought that if you had, you know, athletic ability or academic ability and you didn't use it, that that was just a sin, for lack of a better word. So she really believed that quote in the Bible that to whom much is given, much is expected. And we didn't have a lot in my family in a financial way, but I think a lot of us had a lot of talents, like most people do, you know? And I think that's one of the things about Nanny, is she focused so much on on the good in life. You know, she left the island. She married my grandfather after she'd known him for like a few weeks. Her parents arranged the marriage. And so she moved to the little island off the coast of Venezuela where he lived. And their parents had known each other. Their moms were both from Caracas. And yeah, she knew him for 3 weeks. She moved there. Then he wanted to go be a doctor. And so they got on a boat and came up to New York City. And she, you know, never left the little island in her life where she like went out and picked coffee out the backyard, but he wanted to be a doctor and that was his goal. And in fact, they even made a movie about him called Before His Time. They showed in Canada, I think, during Black History Month every year.
How old were they when they moved? So she left Venezuela right after they got married.
Yeah, she was 23.
I mean, she had 4 kids too, right?
Yeah.
And her husband passed away.
I think she had, I think, 2 in elementary school and 2 in high school when my grandfather died. Yeah, they ended up living in Canada. He went to medical school up there and settled there. When he passed away, she had 4 kids. And she said to me, if he hadn't left her money, there was no way she could have supported herself and those kids. So because of that, she pushed her daughters to go on and get college degrees. And my aunt's, one's almost 80 and the other's in her 90s. So that was not a typical thing for women back then. And she always really pushed getting an education. And of course, you know, Nanny was born in 1900. So her thing was, you get an education in case something ever happens to your husband, you know, which is kind of ironic given that my husband passed away.
Yes.
But all the years when he was alive and I was working, she kept saying to me, "Doesn't Ron make enough money? You know, I can have a job." So she was kind of a mix of, you know, the old world and new ideas. But I think the amazing thing about her, she loved her family unreservedly. And I think that's one of the things that if children have that in life, I think they grow up thinking they can beat the world.
Yes. So love your kids unconditionally and use the talents that you have are the two lessons.
Yeah, I think that would would be very true.
Your husband passed away, and your grandmother drew a lot of strength from her Catholicism. Is your own view from these dark episodes, what is your own view of mortality? Are you also practicing Catholic yourself?
Yes. I used to go to Mass all the time. I don't as often as I used to, and I don't really have a good excuse other than I hate getting up in the morning. But one of the things that Nanny always said, and I still believe that, is that God knows what he's doing even when you don't. And I think when my husband passed away, you know, that was one of the things that I kind of clung to. And she was alive then, and she, you know, knew exactly how I felt because she had lost her husband and she had four kids. And she just said, you know, that have faith that things will turn out. And that tends to be true. I mean, I feel like I have a really wonderful life. You know, I remarried. I have another daughter who's almost 16, and I have three other great kids that are older and grandkids, and I love my job. And, you know, I'm sitting here in Santa Monica looking at the beautiful weather. So, yeah, I guess one thing that I got from her, too, is that you can't always understand things while they're happening, and sometimes not even after, but you just take on faith that things will work out and keep working. That's the other thing. My mom used to say that too, that, you know, she says, yeah, God helps those who help themselves. But if you work like hell while you're waiting for him to help you, it'll get done a lot quicker.
Now, I promise this will be the only sort of overly philosophical question, but are you afraid of death? Is that something that comes to your mind a lot?
No, I could think of a lot worse things than death. I'm very fortunate in that one of the things, reasons I think people are afraid of dying is they have regrets. They haven't done the things they want to do. They haven't. And I think because my husband passed away when I was, it's about 35, 36. You know, that certainly changed the way I thought about things. And Ron was a great guy. He worked hard his whole life. And there were a lot of things that he wanted to do that he never got around to doing because he always thought there'd be time later. So now if I want to do something, I do it. You know, if Ron is fighting in a tournament in Tunisia, I buy a plane ticket and I go to Africa. If, you know, I want to take the whole family on a cruise, I do it. If I want to, you know, start a startup when I'm 50 years old and make games, I do it. So, you know, when I look back, I've had a lot of accomplishments, experiences in education, academics. I published scientific articles. I wrote a book that came out last year with Jim Pedro Sr. I have wonderful children. So the things that I want to do, I don't, if I died right now, I have no regrets.
Beautiful. I guess that is what you, that's sort of the standard by which you hope to live life. There's no regrets. You're ready to go at any moment.
Well, that's it. You know, you want to live like you might die tomorrow because you might die tomorrow.
Yes. So it's clear, I think, that you're as competitive as it gets, especially in judo. Where did that competitive drive come from? Were you born with it? Is it something your grandmother inspired?
It was certainly not something my grandmother inspired. Oh, my gosh. I remember one time I was visiting her when I was in graduate school, I think, and I was training for some tournament. I was always training for some tournament. And I said, I was going out running. And she said, where are you running to? And I said, well, I'm going to run to the park and back because there's a commons in Halifax where she lives. It's a ways from her house. And so I'm going to run to the commons and back. So she said, you're running to the commons then? And I said, no, I'm not running to the commons. I'm just running. And she said, you're not running to anywhere? You're just going to go run in a circle? She said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. She said, if I run, you know, it's because I'm late for Mass or I'm trying to get to the grocer before it closes. You just run for no reason? So, no, my grandmother, she thought sports were kind of it was an incomprehensible thing to her. Why would you go out and expend effort for no reason?
Yeah, did you ever, have you ever questioned the sort of the absurdity of sport, you know, dedicating a big chunk of your life, training hard, sometimes several times a day, to, you know, play essentially against another person?
Every damn day. And, you know, there's a brilliant phrase about coaching that said you need to be smart enough to do it and dumb enough to believe it's important. And, you know, some people have thought that I was bitter because I never was asked to be the Olympic coach. Actually, many years ago, I was asked to be on the U.S. coaching staff, but I decided to get pregnant instead. No, I never had any interest in that because I guess I wasn't, and I don't mean this literally, but I wasn't dumb enough to believe it was important. And by that, I mean the time it takes to coach somebody at the Olympic level. If you really have some integrity as a person, as a coach, you're not going to keep somebody back. And I know what it would take. You know, it's a full-time job. And I never wanted to do that because I wanted to have a full-time job. You know, I think math changes people's lives more than sports does. I see lots of people who were really good at sports when I was young who are having a hard time of it at my age. And I don't see too many people who are really good at math who are having a hard time of it. So it was not what I wanted to do. And I do coach now. I mean, to this day, I teach at Gompers Middle School every Friday. But to be a coach at the level I was a competitor was never something I wanted to do. And so, you know, maybe that makes me a selfish person, but I think you can give back in other ways. You can give back financially to the community. You can give back, you know, by helping people get an education. But I think that many of the things people say about judo or sports in general are very skewed. For example, I hear people say all the time, well, judo builds character. And that is true for some people. But for some people, maybe it's like Rhonda says, it doesn't build character, it reveals it. And, yeah. You know, judo is a sport in this country where you can be fairly mediocre and still place in the national championships.
Yes.
Maybe even win them. I mean, I know the last year, I think Rhonda fought in the nationals. There were 7 or 9 people in her division.
Right.
You know, so you came out top out of less than 10 people. And so, you know, the person who got third, I don't even know who it was. So no disrespect to that person because I don't know who it was. But, you know, they maybe won one match and they go back and I'm, you know, the bronze medalist in the national championships. And sometimes that skews people's perspectives. And I think that's true of sports as well. I think it's very unfortunate where you read some of the stories about so many of these athletes that are getting in trouble with drugs and, you know, the law for, you know, assault and this and that. And I think sometimes that's because we overemphasize sports in this country. My youngest daughter plays soccer. And she played for the city team, and they went to the regionals. And the soccer coach, very nice man, and he said to me, you know, not that we don't love having Julie on the team, but I wondered, why is she not playing club soccer? And Julie goes to a prep school, and she has a 4.0, and she sometimes has a 4.0 by the skin of her teeth. You know, she'll get 90.001, but she'll get that A. And I said, I don't think that she can really spare the time away from her studies to put in, you know, 5 nights a week practice and tournaments every weekend. And many people are surprised by that attitude that you would value your child's academics over sports, where I'm actually surprised by the other. So,
yeah, that's a very interesting calculus there that actually I'll in a little bit have to ask you about, because you kind of quit judo for academic purposes and then came back to win a world championship. So there's a kind of balance to strike there. But first, I don't know how well you remember Rhonda's judo matches later in 2007, 2008. I have some questions about the way she approaches judo and whether you've inspired that. So in 2007 World Semis, she went against a girl that gave her a lot of trouble throughout her career, is Edith Busch, this long, lanky girl.
Yeah.
And Rhonda went down by a yuko, and the look on her face as she runs back to the middle is priceless. I think a lot of people now in the UFC have seen that look. It's kind of like a mix of anger, like frustration, maybe determination. But she looks like she wants to like punish the girl forever scoring on her. Basically, she hates losing.
Yes.
Refuses to lose. Do you think that's that's an important character trait for an elite athlete? Like if losing hurts this bad, can a loss crush you to the point like forcing you to quit early? Should a loss weigh on you so heavily?
You know, I don't think there's an answer to that. Because there are two questions. One is, should a loss weigh on you so heavily? And the other is, do you need to be that way to win?
Right.
I don't know if it's true of every sport. You know, like you look at something like snowboarding. All right, well, nobody's getting up there trying to stop you from snowboarding. So maybe it's different in non-combat sports, But I think in combat sports, you have to have that refusal to lose. You're basically coming out there with the determination to impose your will upon another person until they submit. And I have beaten lots of people who had better technique than me, better coaches than me, better everything than me. But by God, I was not going to lose. And, you know, I remember when video cameras first came out. It was very funny because people used to take Super 8 movies, like the old home movies, they had no sound. So often people didn't remember that, you know, the person who was going to see this later could hear you, right? Because that was a new thing. So I was fighting this match in Chicago, and completely my fault. I was an idiot. I don't know what I was thinking. I was trying to get the girl to come to me, toward me, because they used to back off like and try and start the match close to the edge of the mat, because as soon as we went to mat work, they'd crawl out, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to keep her, to get her not to do that, to come towards me. So I back up, so she'd have to come toward me. And I walk and step out of bounds like an idiot. And of course, then it was half a point against you. And I hear my friend's coach was taping this, and I hear them talking on the tape, and they go, oh no, she got a score on Anne Marie. She should have done that. She's going to pay. And yeah, I mean, I slammed her. And I wasn't very good at throwing. You know, I was more into power. I was so mad. So it was even her fault. But yes, that's...
Is that something you're born with, or can it be trained? Do you remember like a switch turning on at some point in your life, or has it just always been there?
You know, I don't... You know, when I was a little kid, like, you know, really little, I don't remember being all that competitive. You know, I... Three brothers and a sister, and we fought and, you know, we always tried to be the best at stuff, but we were just being little kids. But no, I don't know why it is. When I started judo, when I heard there were national championships, I decided I was going to win them. You know, I was probably 12.
Can you talk about that? Like what it was like to be a woman practicing in a time of, it was a male dominated sport for the most part, right? Was there a lot of sexist BS you had to put up with?
There was, but I think I had an advantage. I remember some guy getting an Oscar thanking his parents for the advantage of bringing him up poor. Mm-hmm. And I actually understood what he meant about it. Sometimes if you don't have advantages, you have to make your own. But, you know, a lot of the girls that I fought against were Japanese American. They did judo as part of their culture. They did it at the Japanese American Community Center. They also did kata. They were taught to be very technically good and, you know, and to look nice. So they wouldn't be like groveling around in the mat. And I grew up in a really tough neighborhood and got in lots and lots and lots of fights and left home very early and was living on my own in an even worse neighborhood. And I mean, I got in fist fights on a daily basis. So a judo match, that was nothing. I mean, you know, if you got knocked down, nobody got to kick you. The referee made him stop and you got up. So yeah, there was a lot of sexist BS, but truly, I think there's more now.
Yeah, right. It's better hidden now.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, people are more subtle about it. They don't say, you can't compete because you're a woman or we're not going to have women's divisions. But the way they treat women in their clubs, and judo is far worse from what I've seen, but I've only seen a limited amount. So from what I've seen of Brazilian jiu-jitsu and MMA, judo is far worse than either of those as far as the subtle and sometimes blatant sexism.
There's also probably, given your style of judo, was there, I'm sure you had to deal with the pressure of, you know, that your judo is not this pretty Japanese judo. Did you just ignore that?
Oh yeah, I didn't give a rat's ass. It's like, right. I won.
Winning is everything.
Hayward Nishioka is fabulous. He made a comment once when somebody was talking about, you know, all that wrestling around and oh, that stuff, that's not judo. And Hayward said, well, we better learn whatever it is then because it's judo.
Yep. Beautifully said. So you got your first degree, I think, at 19?
Yes.
There's this crazy balance of work, academics, and judo. You worked full-time. You trained full-time. You won a lot of major competitions at that time. And then at some point, you took a break from judo to pursue a master's. Can you describe the decision that was going through your mind there when you decided to take a break from judo?
Well, for one thing, graduate school was a little more challenging than being an undergrad. And secondly, I was in Minnesota, and the club I was at the time, I just really didn't get along with the coach. And there wasn't any other really competitive club up there. I had moved up there to train with that club. And then Diane Pierce, who was at the time the woman who won the most in the U.S. ever in history. She's amazing. And she was at that club. And then her husband that she, well, I don't know if he was her husband now, but Miguel Tudela was also there. He was on the 1980 Olympic team. Steve Sack, who was on the 1980 Olympic team, was also there. Right about the time I moved up there, Miguel and Steve and Diane all ended up moving to L.A. So that kind of sucked. And I also, I was fighting 48 kilos, and I grew. I actually grew a couple inches after, you know, about the time I was 19. So I was really having a hard time cutting the weight, and the coach wanted me to, you know, keep cutting weight and do whatever I needed to do. And somebody else came up and offered to give me speed so I could cut weight. This is somebody from this club, right? And I'm thinking, all right, you want me to take drugs so I can make the weight to, you know, obviously they don't have my best interest at heart.
Right.
And so I just said, screw this. And I'm done with judo. I'm going to, you know, I'd already won the U.S. Open. There wasn't a world championships. I'd won the U.S. Nationals. I'd won the collegiate nationals. I'd won the junior nationals. So I just said, screw this. I'm going to focus on my academic career and make money.
Yes.
And so.
But they did start the world championships, I don't know, early 80s.
I think the first one was 1980, and I was in graduate school.
And so what was the thought process of deciding to come back? Because I think you dominated for leading up to the world championships. You won a few major tournaments. So what was the thought process of coming back to judo?
Well, it's funny. I thought I forget exactly. My friend Becky Scott, I remember I was in Rebecca, and I were on a number of teams together. She's a really good friend of mine. Lives in Kansas City. In fact, my youngest daughter, Julia Rebecca, is named after her. So I was on vacation in Halifax, actually, visiting my grandmother. And I got a call from Becky when I got back. Said, where the hell have you been? They're going to, you know, they're looking at putting women in the Olympics, and they're going to have this Olympic festival, and you need to get back in training, and you need to go. So I started back training. I think, God, it's been over 30 years. I think my first tournament back, I'm pretty certain this is what happened. Eve Aronoff choked me out. I'd been back like working out about a couple of months, and she choked me out and beat me. I was so pissed. And that was it. So I came back and I thought, well, I'm not taking this shit. So I came back and I won everything. And America never beat me again. I won everything and went off the Pan Am Games and won that. Went to the Austrian Open and won that. And went to the Pacific Rims and won that. And
it all culminated in the World Championships. Beautiful. But how were you able to balance your love of math with the love of competition? And really being an adult at this point, the responsibility of having to do adult things.
You know, I don't buy all this crap that people say, well, I can't train because, you know, you got to all support me and kick in. I can't train full time. No, you can. Because you know what? You don't train 10 hours a day. I would get up in the morning and lift weights or go run, which shows you how motivated I was because I really hate getting up in the morning. So I'd have a workout, you know, 5:30 to 7 a.m. or something like that. Shower, go to work, you know, and on my lunch hour, I would go run 8 miles. Or General Dynamics, I was working there as an engineer. They had a weight room. Of course, it was all guys and me, but whatever. So, yeah, so I would work out on my lunch hour. And then after work, I would pick Mari up from daycare, and I would take her with me to the gym. And my friend had a daughter who did judo a lot, too. So a lot of times, my friend Sharon would watch Maria while I was working out. And that was it. So I would work out before work. I'd work out at lunch, and I'd work out after work.
You just make it happen if it's important to you. Got it.
Exactly. Well, you know, I don't know who came up with that, you know, if you want to, you'll find a way. And if you don't want it bad enough, you'll find an excuse. And I think a lot of people don't want it bad enough.
Right. I saw a video of on YouTube of you and Rhonda. I think it's called Elder Abuse by Rhonda, where two of you are fighting it out in the living room. Can you talk about, you know, your relationship in terms of coach and student with Rhonda? Like, how much did you guide her judo development early and later?
Well, obviously a lot when she was young because she lived at home until she was 16 and a half, and she was already number one in the U.S. when she left home. You know, when she was young, there were a couple things about her that made her stand out. So I called USA Judo and I talked to somebody in the office, and I said, I have this daughter who I think has a lot of talent potential. And, you know, your junior development program, whatever you have laid out to do for high potential juniors, I would like to get a copy of that. And they laughed at me and said, that would be a good thing to have, wouldn't it? So they were useless. So I had never had any interest in coaching at that level, but this is my baby, right? So I sat down and tried to figure out what is it that I did that made me successful. And then I would go and talk to other people I knew whenever I'd be at tournaments or that and say, you know, you were on the Olympic team, you placed fifth. You know, what if you could go back to your 15-year-old self, you know, Ron's 15 now, if you could go back to your 15-year-old self, what would you do different? And so I asked a lot of people I knew what their ideas were. And then one of the things that I thought would be good for Rhonda is to get, learn from the best. Often with coaches, athletes are held back because they learn whatever that person is good at. And so if your instructor is really good at Seinagi, you learn drop Seinagi even if you're 6'4". And so I took her to my friend Tony Mojica's place because Tony is really good technically. He had a couple of other guys there, Willie Pena, Richard Elizalde, who were really good, especially with stand-up technique, which is not my forte. And so they worked with her a lot. And then, you know, I taught her how to do coaching Bakakomi just because it's my very favorite thing, so I could not teach her anything. And after she'd been doing judo for a year, I started teaching her mat work because I didn't want her to start teaching her myself from the beginning, because then I thought, you know, kids tend to be too much a mirror of their parents, you know, especially if your parent is a world champion. So I started her taking her to Tony's. And then after a year, I started teaching her mat work. And then I also started taking her to other clubs because there's different styles in judo. And I thought if you learned all of them, well, there's basically two main ones. You know, there's the typical stand-up pretty Japanese judo style with a big emphasis on beautiful throws. And then there's a more European style where it's more physical. And I figure if you could get both of those down, you'd be a real threat. And then on top of that, if you could get really good mat work, then the other thing I focused on a lot with her is transition, because I felt that was a real strength of mine. There's that second when you hit the mat, if the other person isn't quite ready, you can take advantage of that. So we did a lot of transition. We did a lot of mat work combinations, a lot of what I call mat work uchikomi, a lot of drills, situation drills. So
yeah, that's something you actually talk a lot about in your Winning on the Ground book, is the transition. It's kind of common sense. There's guys who are good at stand-up, and there's guys who are good on the ground, but the transition is probably the most important part, and at least in my experience, it's not worked on nearly as much as it should.
Well, it's like I said, working on advantage, you know, turning disadvantages into advantages. When you go to Japan, like I lived in Japan for a year. I went to Waseda University my junior year of college. And the mats are packed, right? Because they have so many judo players. And so people always say, well, you know, we can't compete against them. They have so many judo players to choose from. But what it means, if you have so many judo players, you can't really do transition because it's too crowded. So you yes. could take, so you know they're not working on that much. And so you take that disadvantage and you turn it into advantage and say, well, we don't have that many people. We've got, you know, 12 people on the mat. So every time somebody hits the mat, I used to yell at her. I remember Gracie Jividen, who, it's funny, Rhonda fought her in the finals in her first Olympic trials. And I knew Grace since she was a teenager. And she came off the mat at the U.S. Open one time, and her coach said something about that was really good, how she, you know, followed somebody through from the throw right into the pin. And Grace said, well, I had to because Anne Maria would have killed me. And this is like years later, right? And the coach is like, who's Anne Maria? And she goes, yeah, I still hear your voice in my head. God damn it, Jividen, you better follow her in the mat. I will come out there and kill you myself.
So in the 2008 Olympics, I have to bring it up because I'm probably bitter about it. But Ron had six matches, and she lost only one match against Edith Busch. This very long and awkward Edith Busch. Rhonda tossed her for Ippon, like I said, a year before in the semis of the Worlds. But at the Olympics, Busch played this really incredibly cagey game, just playing the gripping game and going for these like non-throws, these makikomi turns that had no chance of throwing. Sorry to be showing bias in this. And Rhonda kept attacking with big legitimate throws. What did you think about that match? How did you feel watching it?
Well, I have to say at the end of it, you know, when Rhonda got countered, it came down to, even though maybe Bosch's throws weren't legit, she would have won the decision. I mean, I've seen enough of you to know that she would have won the decision. Rhonda did exactly what she had to do at that point. You know, she threw a Hail Mary pass, because if you're behind, losing by a point, losing by a decision is still a loss. And so she did a very wise thing, and she took a chance. Now, the chance didn't pay off, but, you know, it was the right thing to do.
But you think she would have lost the decision? Yes. See, I never know how to score these things, because to me, you know, you kind of have to judge the legitimacy of the throws.
I go into every decision assuming I'm going to lose, and I always told her and everybody else I ever coached, if you leave it to the referee, you have no room to bitch. It shouldn't have got there. So, yeah, there was no score, and she, you know, did what she had to do. I think that's one of the reasons that Rhonda was happy to go from judo to MMA, that there's less – you can't run and hide. And I do not fault Edith at all. She did not cheat. She played within the rules. You don't have to play within other rules that other people make up.
Right.
But the rules in judo, and, you know, this kind of goes back to what you were saying about how it's different now. It was always bad enough, and it's gotten worse, where the referees can interject themselves into a match.
Right.
And so it's, you know, judo is not a fight. I think when I competed, it was much more a fight.
Right. Now it's more strategy and
now it's a demonstration.
Yes.
And when people say, how come nobody, you know, judo isn't a spectator sport, and I hear all these silly things, but I was talking to my husband about this, and he said, yeah, when you come out to visit me the first time and you want to go see a judo match because some of your buddies were there, and so we went and watched this tournament at some local high school, and he asked me what I thought about it at the end, and really what I thought was, it looks like two people in pajamas tussle around on the mat, and then at the end, for no apparent reason, one of them is declared the winner.
Yeah. And it's actually funny, because Rhonda is famous now outside of the world of judo. You can read YouTube comments about her judo matches, and people are like, you know, she's cool, but I have no idea what's going on. So like, it's fun. To me, it seems clear what's going on, but then you have to take a step back and... Yeah, I guess it is two people in pajamas doing something weird and somebody wins in the end.
Well, a lot of the rules are stupid. You know, like your gi has to be this length. Your gi has to be this color. If you have a little piece of metal in your hair tie, you're disqualified. I mean, it's just so asinine. I can tell you the amount of time, because obviously I coached a lot of little girls over the years. The amount of time I spent checking little girls' ponytails to make sure there wasn't a slight piece of metal in it so they wouldn't get disqualified. Just nonsense like that. You know, I've been at local tournaments where they disqualify a kid because he has a blue gi and he's on the white side. And I teach at a middle school in South Central LA, and I'm really reluctant to take my kids to local tournaments because I don't want them to have a bunch of people yelling at them for stupid stuff.
So when I saw Rhonda fight in 2008 Olympics, it was clear to me that she could be one of the greatest judo players America's ever produced, maybe the best in the world. So when she decided to switch from judo to MMA, what was the conversation between you and her like? Did you have doubts? Did she have doubts?
Well, I was against it, and I was wrong. Rhonda cannot hear me say that enough, by the way.
This is the one time you were wrong.
All right. I told her it was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard in my life, that I was working at USC. She could go to any – USC has a deal with like 500 different private universities in the United States. She could go to any one of them for free. Rhonda's really smart. She went to a science magnet. You know, she went, she took the test at the local college, tested in calculus. You know, she's really, she could have, we assumed that she would come back from the Olympics. She'd have done all this sports stuff. Now she'd been to two Olympics. She could go to college. She'd get a degree. You know, we figured she'd end up with a PhD in marine biology or something. And instead she says, no, I want to be a cage fighter. And I said, first of all, listen, I'm an old woman. I've supported you through two Olympics. You're an able-bodied adult, and I'm not going to support you anymore. You know, can get a job. If you're not going to go to college, I'm going to be those people that have their kids that are 32 living in their house. I mean, you see a lot of these judo kids, and their parents are still supporting them. Yeah. My mom didn't support me after I was 15 years old. What the hell's wrong with you people? Oh, it's my dream. I said, yeah, well, I have a dream to retire someday. So... I told her it's the dumbest thing I ever heard. She says, give me a year. So I said, fine, you can move back into your old room downstairs. You know, you do this thing for a year. And if you're you know, not making money by then, you go to college. So she said, okay. And then her first several fights she was supposed to have, the other girl backed out. I mean, it wasn't just one person. So this is kind of confirming Mike, it's a stupid ass idea. And one of the coaches, he was just flat honest about it. He said, we looked your girl up on YouTube, but she will kill our girl. There's no way. So, yeah, she was training, you know, at all these places and working a few minimum wage jobs and, you know, working at 24-hour fitness on the midnight shift, graveyard shift, and then going up and, you know, doing grappling and doing boxing. And so then she goes and has a few amateur fights. And, you know, it was okay, but I still didn't see any point to it. I mean, yeah, you're really good at this. You're winning. That's nice. But, you know, you're really good at judo and you have no money and no education and no work experience. And what are you going to do? You know, so this kind of goes back to your whole question about, do I think that it's absurd we spend so much on something that's essentially play? I mean, I think it is. And sometimes when I hear people say, oh, and Billy Bob Joel has, you know, the most medals in whatever sport it is than anybody in history, I think, well, that's because you're 36 years old. Why don't you have a job? You know, Bodie Miller's okay because, I mean, I guess that's his job and they pay him. But,
yeah,
you know, and maybe that's what you want to do. Maybe you want to be like the world's greatest surfer and that's fine, but I'm not supporting you, you know?
And who knows what life is about? Maybe, you know, maybe a successful career and a stable job is not what is not the epitome of what, you know, there's something beautiful about being that American hero and winning an Olympics at age 25 and then that's it.
Yeah, but and the other thing is, I mean, it's cool. If you're 36 and you want to be going for the Olympics or whatever you want to do, that's perfectly cool. But I don't think your 60-year-old parent should still be supporting your sorry.
That's true.
That's my point. True. You know, you want to live in poverty and train for fencing or whatever, that's fine. You know, but don't expect other people to be, you know, supporting you because it's my dream. Well, good. If it's your dream, you get off your ass and you make it happen. So, yeah, I was not, as you can gather, the most enthused about this. But she lived at home for about 2 months and then she got some sponsors and moved out and was living in some house with actually some very nice people. And, you know, she got, did what you do when you're young, got a bunch of roommates and was living, you know, fairly cheap and training. And then it kept building up and building up. And, you know, now she's on the beach in Venice.
And got you to admit being wrong on one thing.
Yes. Well, I was wrong on a number of counts. One of the things I was concerned about was the money that I thought, you know, this is just going to be a big waste of your time. You're going to be, you know, 2 or 3 years more back from actually getting a real job and getting an education. And the other thing was I was concerned because, you know, judo is sexist and it treats women poorly as it is. And I thought MMA is going to be far worse, you know, and it actually wasn't. The people I have met in general have been really respectful to me, to Rhonda. I think one thing might be, and I'm a very cynical person, so one thing might be there's a lot of money in it. So when she's, you know, bringing in hundreds of thousands of dollars for an organization yeah. in profit, they're inclined to treat her a little more nicely.
Yes. That's when people get to be nice, which is, you hate to be cynical about it, but that's the way the world works. When in judo, when there's very little money, people get bitter and negative. And so money, while it corrupts, it has positive aspects too.
But, you know, I mean, look at Kayla Harrison, you know, nice young woman. She wins a gold medal in the Olympics. And I don't see her getting tons of money for it. I don't even see people that often saying, oh, well, come out and do a clinic for us. You know, we'll pay you a couple thousand dollars. I mean, you know, sometimes people do. But I think given the level at which she's accomplished, I just suspect that if she had been a man, she would have gotten a lot more payoff out of that.
Yeah. So Rhonda is not just a woman. It's a man or a woman. It also matters that the person is very interesting and she's a very interesting person. And I think that's why people love watching her. She's got beautiful jiu-jitsu and judo. She's got a very interesting personality and that's what they love watching. It's not because she's a woman. There's a lot of women in MMA. And I think it's not always the woman, man. It's about who you are, and she's definitely a character of the Chael Sonnen type.
Well, I think Rhonda has a different attitude And I think, well, Chael Sonnen, maybe a little bit of his is fake, but hers is real.
Yes, she is more real.
Has to kill you and eat you in that cage to win. If there's no rule against it, she will do it.
Yep, it's beautiful. So take a little sidestep going from the field of battle to the academic field of math. Something I hear a lot is the United States is ranked 25th out of 38 major industrialized nations in math skills amongst 15-year-olds. Why do you think America performs so poorly in math relative to other countries?
I think there's a couple of reasons, and it's probably the same reasons that we perform so poorly in judo. You get good at something by doing a lot of it. And I don't see our kids, as a general rule, doing nearly as much studying as kids in some other countries. And one of the reasons may be because they have a lot more time in after-school sports. You know, you asked how I spent so much time, you know, how I managed to succeed academically and in sports and work full-time. Well, one reason is I didn't have a TV. I never watched TV, literally never, because I didn't have a TV. And you just took, if you took all of the time that kids spend watching TV and had them spend that doing math, boy, that would skyrocket. And then if you added the time they spend playing computer games on top of that, they'd be number one in the world.
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the problems, this might be anecdotal evidence. I grew up in Russia, where being good at math was much more respected than it is in this country. It was, I dare say, almost cool to be good at math or good at school, get good grades, to be intelligent and well-read. I don't quite see that. You know, when I went to school here, which is late middle school, high school, you almost have to, like, hide when you do well, like when you get good grades. It was almost like the opposite of cool. Performing well in sports was what was cool. Do you think that it boils down to that, that math is just not cool?
I think that's one thing. And I think another thing that just drives me insane is kids are constantly told that we're not good at math, that they're not good at math, that Asian American kids are good at math, but other kids aren't good at math. And I make it a point. Like, I teach judo in an inner-city middle school, and my class is usually probably half African-American, half Latino kids, probably evenly divided. And I make it a point all the time to talk about I run a technology company. I make games that teach math. You know, how are you guys doing in math? We are having a club scrimmage, and anybody who has a grade below a C can't come because it's a school, it's an after-school activity. You can't come. I don't care how good you are at judo. And, you know, I think that we're always telling kids they're not good at math. And we do the same thing with our kids in judo and say, oh, you know, the Cuban women are good. The Japanese women are good. And I just tell Rhonda, there's nothing those women do that you can't do. They go climb ropes. There's a rope. It's two stories high. It's San Monica Beach. Climb it. Do it again.
Yeah.
And it's the same way with my little Julia, who is in honors algebra too. And she complains and whines and says, you know what? Well, I studied for this test and I got a C. I said, well, study more the next time. So I think I even wrote a blog about that the other day. I think our expectation of how much work we have to we should be expected to do to be successful is a little off.
Yeah.
That's particularly true in math. And the problem with math is it's hierarchical. So if you don't understand multiplication, you're not going to get division. Right. If you don't understand fractions, you're probably not going to make it in algebra. And so if you fall out of the way, you know, early on, then later on you think I'm stupid because no matter how much you study, you don't get it because you're missing some of those foundational pieces.
Yeah, that's the complaint I get with people. At some point they fall off, they fall behind a little bit because math is hard. I mean, that's the thing I hear a lot is math is hard. But I think that's the point. It's supposed to be hard. And you're supposed to work hard to understand it and to get good at it. Like, school is not supposed to be easy. I guess we let people off the hook too early.
Well, I tell them, so what? You know, when you were a little baby, walking was hard. And you fell down and you cried, you know, go home and ask your mom. But now you walk all the time. You don't give it a thought. So the stuff that, you know, when you were in second grade, multiplication tables were hard. But now you never think about what 6 times 8. So, yeah, it's hard until you get it down. And I think we don't have enough encouragement for kids. They don't spend enough time. I mean, that's why I went to making these computer games instead of retiring, because I really think it's an opportunity to make a difference. you know, winning at world championships was great. I mean, it's great. It was one of the greatest experiences of my life. And for me personally, it was great. It gave me confidence to do things and take risks. And, you know, even when my husband passed away, that sense of, you know, I have accomplished things other people haven't and I will make it, you know. Being good at math and teaching kids who otherwise might not have learned, if we can make these games work, it will make a difference in millions of people's lives.
Yes. Yeah, for their whole life.
Exactly.
Yep. You've trained and associated with interesting characters of the likes of, you know, Jean LaBelle, who I think represent that, how should I put it, the mean, the American mean aggressive, you know, catch wrestling approach to grappling. What do you think is more important in the grappling sports, combat sports, aggression or technique?
Aggression.
Aggression.
You have to have both, though. I mean, because I've fought a lot of people who are really tough, but you have to know what you're doing. You can't just charge at people.
But you have to have that killer instinct, that aggression.
Right, right. Technique alone won't do it. Aggression alone won't do it.
So I have to ask, you're an armbar specialist, Rhonda is as well. So have you ever broken an arm? Or more importantly, do you think it's hard? Do you have like mental blocks, ethical blocks almost, of when you put a girl in an arm and she's not tapping?
Well, I wouldn't have admitted this when I was competing, but yes. I mean, like when I would fight in like local tournaments, I remember one time this cute little girl, Karen, came out to fight me. And I remember her being around the dojo when she was like, you know, 9, 10 years old. And I was, you know, probably 16 or 17 and foot sweeping her. And she was a cute little thing, right? And so, you know, 7 years later, I'm in my 20s and she's 16 and she's my size. Well, there's no way I'm going to armbar Karen. But she had actually pretty good technique. You know, she was from a good club and yeah, she probably could have foot swept or something, you know, but, you know. So as soon as I could, I threw her an arm and pinned her. But my point is, I wouldn't let them know that because I'm sure she was terrified coming out to fight me. But yeah, I'm not going to break somebody's arm to win like the local YMCA championships.
But say, let me put you in an ethical dilemma then. Say you're in the world championship finals match. And no, wait. This is more complicated. And you've been dominating the match. You're like way up on points and there's 30 seconds left. And you put a girl in an arm bar and she's not tapping. Do you break it at that point?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I am there. First of all, I mean, if you're in the world finals, you know where you are. You know if your arm's going or not. You're an adult. You're top of the game. You're there representing your country and I'm there representing America. And I am there to take home a gold medal for my country.
and the arm. Got it. So Rhonda is, she's one of the great trash talkers in all of combat sports, I think. Different than Chael Sonnen, it's simple, direct, aggressive. But in judo, the tradition...
Unlike Chael, Rhonda backs it up. I mean, Chael talks himself into these fights and loses. Rhonda talks herself into him and wins.
Very true. But in judo, there's a tradition to be more reserved and quiet and respectful. What do you think of the difference between MMA and judo in this respect? Do you like a bit of trash talking?
I don't know that judo is all that much more respectful. I think that sometimes if someone disrespects you and you're expected to just take that, I guess I've never been that good at turning the other cheek. And I think sometimes that let's all get along stuff in judo. I mean, there's been a number of high profile cases with, you know, referees, judges, molesting athletes, and oh, we don't want to say anything about it. USA Judo is very bad as far as financially supporting their athletes. We don't want to say anything about it. So I think that whole let's all get along is not always a good thing. And I think that, like Dr. Seuss said, you know, be who you are and say what you feel, because those who matter don't mind and those who mind don't matter.
That's right. So Rhonda is fighting Sarah McMahon this weekend. Do you watch her fights or is it too nerve-wracking?
They are nerve-wracking, but I always go, I've missed one. She had one in Canada, and I had already promised to babysit my grandchildren at the National Hispanic Journalist Conference. My daughter and son-in-law were both speaking on a panel, so I went down to babysit the grandkids. But other than that one, I've been to all her fights. I'm the very loud, screaming lady.
So what's your prediction for this weekend?
I think she'll armbar.
And as quickly as possible?
I do. I tell her, look, I can only hold my breath for so long. I'm an old lady prone to heart attacks. Just take the first thing that comes and let's go out for chicken wings.
I do want to mention your book, Winning on the Ground, which I thought was awesome. It has a lot of great techniques, philosophy of attacking transitions, mindset stuff, how to drill, how to train, so on. But one thing I saw in there early on, you mentioned the difference between being number one in the world and number 100 isn't so much the hours you put on the mat, it's what you're doing in those hours. So if you had to give one advice on how to spend your time on the mat, what would you say? So I'd say for recreational and for elite judoka.
For elite judoka, think about if somebody was trying to beat you, what would they be doing and work on that.
Ah. But for recreational?
Whatever your goal is. If you're there to have a good time and lose 10 pounds and have better cardio, there is nothing wrong with that. And, you know, any idiot that wants to make you feel less because you're not training for, you know, the Olympics. My friend, Dr. Jake Flores, was at Henry with a lot of us, and he decided he wanted to go to medical school. And he is a wonderful doctor. He's also had two sons on the world team for judo. If you're there because you want to get in shape, and that's cool. You know, if it's just a less boring thing than running on the treadmill, that's great. Don't let anybody make you feel less of that. Just do whatever you want to do and go home. And don't try and be some hero and go get pounded by somebody who's training for, you know, international competition. If they're not a jerk, they would probably appreciate you, like, taking falls for them on the crash pad or, you know, working with them on drills. And, you know, they probably appreciate that. If they are a jerk and beat the crap out of you, hell with them. They're a jerk. You know, if you're a jerk with a gold medal, you're still just a jerk.
And like you said several times, you just have to remember that it is the sport thing is just a little game. Not to take it too seriously. For a recreational player, you either have to be what is it you said? Smart enough to train right and dumb enough to believe it matters.
Smart enough to do it and dumb enough to believe it's important.
That's right. Like I said, you have a blog at dranmaria.blogspot.com. You also have an awesome, for those interested, statistics blog at thejuliagroup.com/blog. You're all over the place on Twitter, Dr. Ann Maria. Anywhere else?
Yeah, Seven Generation Games. The number 7, Generation Games. You should go there and buy our game because our chief marketing officer would really like that you did, because she was the one that called me for this podcast.
Awesome. Is there anyone else you'd like to thank especially or to curse? So Seven Generation Games is your big effort now.
Yes. Every time I speak to anyone, I think our marketing officer cringes a little bit because I said, you know, it's all about learn math and kill things. Digital things shows makes me mad. But, you know, kids like it. Our results so far show that the kids in the pilot improve their math scores 3 times as much as the control group. So we actually do real science. I'm smarter than I look. That's gone on my tombstone.
What age group is it targeted towards?
Right now, we're aimed at 4th through 6th graders, and we're coming out with 2 more games by the end of the year, one which will be at the upper end, probably 6th to 7th grade, and the other that'll be more for 3rd and 4th. We're coming out with our first iPad game this summer, too.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Oh, you're welcome. Now I'm going to go back to work because that game's not going to write itself.